One of the greatest gifts God has given us is our children. They're also a great responsibility. Raising children is a challenge. Raising good children is a big challenge, and raising godly children is an incredible but possible challenge. There are several important ingredients needed to raise godly children. One is teaching children to obey. Another is teaching them to show respect and honor. Then, too, parents must protect children from evil. It is a false philosophy that says you produce better children by exposing them to the filth of this world. Romans 16:19 says, "I would have you wise unto that which is good, and simple or ignorant concerning evil." Many parents in our day are accused of overprotecting their children. Could I give you my observation of that? We don't lose our children because of being overprotective. We lose our children because of being harsh and critical, or from being inconsistent in our own lives. By far, the majority of families I know are not protective enough of their children. Teaching obedience and respect and protecting children from evil are key ingredients necessary to raise godly children, but they are not the key ingredient. In fact, you may have those ingredients and still not succeed in raising a wise, godly child without the key ingredient. In Proverbs 23:26, we read, "My son, give me thine heart." Malachi 4:6 is a prophecy concerning the ministry of John the Baptist, "And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers." But that's not the end of the verse. The verse ends with a warning of what God does if fathers don't turn their hearts to their children, "lest I come and smite the earth with a curse." We're witnessing the fulfillment of that verse all around us when children shoot children, and when schools have to have armed guards and metal detectors, and when people are afraid to walk city streets alone. Luke 1:17 is a further exposition of Malachi 4:6. "And he," referring to John the Baptist, "shall go before him," Jesus, "in the spirit and power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient," that's the children, "to the wisdom of the just." That's what parents are supposed to be. The number one characteristic of wisdom is justice. When children see parents as just rather than unjust, then children are more likely to cease their disobedience and rebellion and give their hearts to their parents. The last phrase of the verse says this, "to make ready a people prepared for the Lord." Young people are not prepared for God to work in their lives until their hearts are turned from themselves or from others to their parents. Now, I've given you the passages where the truth is stated. Let me tell you where the truth is illustrated. 2 Samuel 13 and 14 are the chapters that tell how King David lost his son Absalom's heart. Absalom and Tamar were full-blooded brother and sister, but David was not as protective of Tamar as he should have been. David allowed Tamar's half-brother Amnon to be alone with Tamar, and Amnon raped his half-sister. David was angry when he heard what happened, but he took no action. 2 years later, Absalom had his half-brother Amnon executed to revenge his sister's rape. Then Absalom fled to Geshur for 3 years. David's general Joab noticed how badly David missed Absalom, so he got the king to bring Absalom back to Jerusalem. But for 2 more years, David refused to talk to his son. Absalom, provoked to wrath by 7 years of his father's failure to act and failure to communicate, sent for General Joab. When Joab didn't come, he had Joab's barley fields set on fire. Those fields on fire were a picture of Absalom's heart burning with anger and rejection and distress because of being cut off from his father David. Finally, Joab came and Absalom said, "I want to see my father. If he wants to kill me, then let him kill me, but I want to see my father." So Joab talked to David, and David sent for Absalom. But the reception Absalom received was not the warm reception of a father. It was the cold reception of a monarch on a throne. When a man is a father, his children must see him first and foremost as a father. Children don't mind a father being something else, but he must primarily be a father to his children. It's all right to be a factory worker, or a pastor, or a businessman, but a father must first be a father to his children. Absalom was treated like a subject when he should have been treated like a son. To those who understand the principles involved, it is no surprise that in the very next verse, 2 Samuel 15:1, Absalom had become a rebel. And he had plotted and was carrying out his plan to usurp his father's throne. Verse 6 of chapter 15 is an enlightening verse. Absalom did to the men of Israel what he apparently wished David his father would have done for him by listening and talking and touching. Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Before the chapter ends, David is running for his life, and Absalom the rebel has taken the throne of Israel. Now please listen carefully as I make one of the most important statements you will ever hear any preacher make in your life. The key ingredient in raising good children is to get their hearts early, keep their hearts, and be extremely vigilant to not lose their hearts. If you do lose your child's heart, then quickly find out where and when you lost it and put into action a plan to get the heart back, no matter what it takes to do it. No matter how much time or trouble or money it takes to get back your child's heart, you must decide you will be willing to pay the price. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train up a child in the way he should go." The Hebrew word for train up means pay the price to dedicate him fully to the Lord. The word is only used a few times in the Old Testament. It is usually translated dedicate. It occurs in 1 Kings 8:63. "So King Solomon and all Israel dedicated the house of the Lord." What price did Solomon pay to dedicate the house of the Lord? It was not cheap. It cost Solomon 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep. And the message is this: whatever it costs you to dedicate and train your children to follow God, then you must be willing to pay the price. You cannot claim the promise of Proverbs 22:6, "Train up the child in the way he should go. When he's old, he will not depart from it," unless you're willing to pay the price. It may cost you financially $1,000 or $10,000. You must be willing to pay the price. It may cost you your job. You must be willing to pay the price. It may require you selling your home and relocating elsewhere. You must be willing to pay the price. It may require you taking several weeks off work to travel one-on-one with your child. You must be willing to pay the price. It may require radical changes in your own personal life. You must be willing to pay the price. It may require days of fasting and praying, as one man I know who fasted 36 days for his son. You must be willing to pay the price. Be sure of this right now. God knows your heart. And God already knows whether or not you love your child enough to be willing to pay the price to deal with his disobedience and rebellion. I've seen many rebels change, but seldom ever have I seen a rebel change who stayed at home where his parents were not willing to pay the price. Before I finish this message, you may feel that I'm somewhat intense, and it's because I've lived through the learning of what I'm speaking. The date was December the 21st, 1992, that my telephone rang. A very distraught mother was on the other end of the line. As I listened, I found that for a year and a half, they had had problems with their now 17-and-a-half-year-old son, Michael. It all seemed to have started about age 16 when they got Michael his own car and let him get a job at a restaurant. Michael became close friends with a 19-year-old fellow who had attended the same Christian school where Michael was a student. But why don't I allow Michael's mother to tell you their story in her own words? Our son, running around with a friend from church, seemed fine. Boy, were we wrong. Michael soon started staying out late. He was working later and later. On his days off, he went with his friends to their homes to play pool or ping pong. Mr. 19's girlfriend wasn't allowed to go out with him unless her parents went, and so that wasn't a problem. So as far as we knew, Mike and Mr. 19 were just a couple of Christian guys having fun. We totally trusted Mike. We watched him. He seemed to still be having devotions. He was still in church most of the time. His mouth was a little smarter than usual, but we chalked it up to being 16. We also noticed him stretching the rules a little. Some things weren't adding up, but nothing major. Then in November, 4 months after Mike turned 16, we got up one morning and the car was gone. It was 4 a.m. and Mike wasn't home yet. We were both up and suddenly noticed a note on the dining room table. I still remember every word on it, even though it's been 3 years now. It said, "Someone said I couldn't do it. I love you, Mom and Dad. Bye, Mike." We weren't sure what it meant, but we were horrified. First, we ran over to Mr. 19's apartment. No one was there. We checked the garage, but no one was there. About that time, I checked my purse and realized $300 was gone. It was a relief to realize he had taken the money and probably run away. We started searching through Mike's stuff. Boy, were we shocked. We found lots of awful hard rock tapes. Mike set those out for us before he left. We found cigarettes and found out he'd been drinking. We also found pictures he'd drawn of evil, wicked skulls. They gave me chills. Mike had a side we knew nothing about. Mike was found in Florida 5 days later, broke. We had him put in a detention home and went to get him. This family lived in Illinois. Mr. 19, who had gone with Mike, was just left in the street. We had the car impounded, so he had nowhere to go or stay. His parents sent him nothing, so he was left on the streets of Tampa, Florida, with only his clothes. He was scared. He stayed at a police station in a chair. We got there 2 days later. God had started the work, and we brought back both boys. Mike confessed to us everything and asked our forgiveness. We blindly gave it to him. From this point on, Mr. 19 was gone. One part Mike held back was that Mr. 19 had introduced him to pornography. They had started renting X-rated movies. Now, let me pause and interject here that Mike's parents recently told me that they've since been humbled to find out that Mike's first exposure to bad movies was in their own home when Mike was about 10 years old. His parents had tried cable TV with HBO for about 6 months. Mike would watch it when they didn't know about it. Mike also had another friend while growing up whom his parents didn't know about, who provided him access to MTV, rock music tapes, cigarettes, alcohol, dirty movies, and so on, whenever he wanted them. Mike's mother continues, "Mike was fine until the next summer when a girl came into the picture. She seemed like a nice girl, went to church, an A student, worked hard. We liked her. Again, we trusted blindly. Mike was smart-mouthed with us. By this time, we were homeschooling, but I still worked 35 hours a week and my husband 50 hours a week. The children were home alone a lot. There were small things that weren't adding up, but the hard rock music wasn't seen around the house. He wasn't smoking. He never talked mean or ugly to us. His hair was short, neat, and clean. He was always in church. He loved his family. So to us, he was just a struggling good kid. On December 20th, Mike's sister came into our room about 11 o'clock crying. She said she had to talk to us. She told us Mike and a friend had been bringing X-rated movies into the house. She had walked in on them one night. He had a VCR in his bedroom. They threw her out and told her to keep quiet. They didn't care what we or anyone else thought. They were going to do what they wanted. Our daughter also told us he had ruined her birthday slumber party 2 weeks earlier. He had taken one of the girls to the car and was kissing her. He had also been sexually aggressive with all her other 14-year-old friends. It was the morning of the next day, December 21st, that Michael's folks made contact with me. They desperately wanted to know if there was anything they could do to reach their 17-and-a-half-year-old son. Allow me to pause right here and ask you, what would you tell these parents? What can this mom and dad do that would straighten out a 17-and-a-half-year-old son who has now tried about everything the world has to offer, has become deceitful, and shows little or no inclination towards changing? Before I tell you the end of the story, let me first point out to you that rebellion originates in the heart. The heart of every problem is a problem in the heart, and that includes rebellion. In fact, rebellion is more a heart problem than a life problem. Hebrews 3:10 says, "They do always err in their heart." The problem David had was that he had lost Absalom's heart. And Absalom's life wandered because his heart wandered. Many months before Michael ran away from home, Michael's parents had lost his heart. Michael's life wandered because his heart wandered. How easy it would have been for Michael's parents to focus on his running away from home, or on his bad friends, or on his pornography addiction, or on his beer drinking, or on his rock music, or whatever. But all those things were simply symptoms. They were surface. The root cause of all those problems was this: without even knowing how, when, or where it happened, Michael's parents lost their son's heart. I repeat, the heart of every problem is a problem in the heart. I cannot emphasize this too strongly, because this heart that I'm talking about controls everything else in a person's life. Your heart keeps everything else in your life living and functioning. A parent then who has his child's heart will have access to everything else in his child's life. When Michael's mother said he had a side they knew nothing about, she was stating plainly that they did not have his heart. A parent who has his child's heart will know what is going on in his child's life. He can direct his child's feet to go in the right direction. He can protect his child's eyes and ears from wrong pictures or wrong music. And he can determine who his child's friends will be. I remember talking to the parents of a boy I'll call Henry. For 15 years, Henry's parents had never had serious problems with their son. But with tears, they told me something was wrong. When I quizzed them concerning their home, it seemed that they had the perfect home. Both parents were sincere, humble Christians with good standards. They were in a good church. They had no TV. They were careful with newspapers, magazines, and music. Their son was in home school. But something was very wrong. I'll tell you later what was wrong with Henry. Did you know that it is better in the long run to have a child who occasionally disobeys you, but you have his heart, than to have a child who is continually, compliantly obedient, but you don't have his or her heart? Not every child whose parents lose his heart becomes wild or rebellious, but the potential for rebellion is present, regardless of how outwardly obedient a child is, if you don't have his heart. That means this: any parent who does not have his child's heart has a child who has the potential to become a terrible rebel who does horrible things and breaks his parents' hearts. Are you thinking, do you have your child's heart? What would be your child's response to you if you were to ask him or her right now, do I have your heart? Don't forget, the heart of every problem is a problem in the heart. The second key thought is, whoever has the child's heart will eventually have his life and his loyalty. this heart that I'm talking about was not made to be kept. It was made to be given away. Whoever the person is to whom your child gives his heart is also the person who will eventually have his life and his loyalty. How could Michael run away from a safe, secure, love-filled Christian home with his 19-year-old friend? It wasn't hard at all. His friend had his heart. Whoever has the heart will eventually have the child. Now that is the reason that the world is continually pressing upon us and trying to tie children's hearts with everyone and everything, good and bad, except their parents. From babysitters to TV stars to school teachers to cartoon figures to basketball stars to football stars to rock and roll musicians to boyfriends and girlfriends. I've seen children whose hearts were more with some cartoon figure or sports team than with their parents. And sometimes you can tell just by looking at a child's bedroom walls who has his heart. May I ask you, do you right now have your child's heart? Would your child rather spend time with you than almost anyone else? Does your child listen respectfully when you speak? Does your child have a genuine desire to please you? Does it hurt him to displease you? Is he loyal to you in your presence as well as behind your back? Do you know what is going on inside your child? Remember Henry? The reason Henry's parents were having problems with him was because without them hardly even knowing it had happened, after 15 years of virtually no problems, Henry had gotten a girlfriend. One of Satan's biggest ways of getting young people's hearts from their parents prematurely is by getting them to play the boyfriend-girlfriend game. Is there no other alternative to this approach that is so common in our day and yet is destroying so many young people? I believe there's an outstanding biblical alternative whereby a young person plans to give his heart to one other person in life. Then he guards his heart against coveting anyone else before they find that person and after they marry that person. You say, Pastor, where do you find that in the Bible? Let me ask a simple question to answer that. How many Eves did God make for Adam? One. And how many Adams did God make for Eve? One. By going from girlfriend to girlfriend to girlfriend, our young people are not learning how to be committed. They are learning how to break up. Young people who guard their hearts against covetousness are then able to seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness while being friendly, not flirty, with everyone. A fellow is then able to keep his heart with his parents and let them help him find his mate after he's old enough and mature enough for marriage. Michael's parents brought him back from Florida, but they didn't really get his heart back even though they brought him back. It was a really easy thing for Mike to give his heart to a girl, so that problem started up all over again. The third key thought is that children want parents to have their hearts. I love this thought. We're all born with the desire to please our parents, to be close to them, to share things with them, and to get their praise and approval. Here Esau, as he cries in Genesis, "Bless me, even me also, O my father." See David hungering to see Absalom, and Absalom hungering to see David. And there was Michael, before he ran away to Florida, setting everything out so his parents could find it. He was crying out to his parents to get his heart back and help him get his life straightened out. Please listen to me carefully here. I'm about to tell you one of Satan's biggest lies to parents in our day. If the destructive impact of lies could be compared to bombs, this one lie must have the destructive capability of a nuclear warhead. Yet this lie is believed and even joked about by many, many people. I've heard it many times in discussions one-on-one, as well as over radio and in the media. Here's the lie. Some adolescent rebellion is normal and to be expected out of every teenager. Since rebellion is normal and to be expected, then you don't feel like you have to deal with it. Rebellion is not normal. 1 Samuel 15:23 tells us that rebellion is sin and exposes a child to the realm and power and control of Satan. Just a little bit of rebellion should be a sign to a parent that the heart is wandering and is troubled and is hungry for love and attention and acceptance. When a child has a smart mouth, like Michael had, it must not simply be, quote, chalked up to him being 16. A little bit of rebellion is like a fast-growing cancer that multiplies exponentially into a whole mass of life-destroying rebellion. Did you know, fourthly, that the Bible gives us an ideal picture of a parent-child relationship? Think about it. Where is it in the Bible? No, it's not Abraham and Isaac, and it's not Isaac and Joseph, and it certainly wasn't David and his sons. This may surprise you, but the ideal example of the hearts of parents and children being knit together is that of the Heavenly Father and His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. Jesus said in John 5:19, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of Himself, but what He seeth the Father do. For what things soever He doeth, these also doeth the Son likewise." And in John 5:30, Jesus said, "I can of mine own self do nothing. I seek not mine own will, but the will of the Father, which has sent me." And consider Jesus' statement in John 10:30 in this context. "I and my Father are one." That is the ideal picture of a parent-child relationship. There are three big dangers for the heart, and they take place in this order. The heart can be lost, then hardened, then stolen. First of all, the heart can be lost. Perhaps the number one way a father loses his child's heart is by expressing anger at the child. Contrary to what many fathers think, anger does not break a child's will. Anger crushes a child's spirit and causes him to harden his heart. Over and over, when I deal with a rebel child, I find that his father has had a problem with anger. Michael's dad was not angry all the time, but occasionally he would explode and then back off. Fear of explosions of anger can cause a child to retreat into a shell. And when he goes into that shell, he takes his heart with him. I've dealt so much with the problems created by men's anger that I'm continually recommending to men that they ask God to cleanse their lives completely of anger. You say, "But what if someone breaks into my house in the middle of the night and I need to be angry?" You won't need anger even then. You'll need courage and discernment then. Please let this sink in. You and I never need human wrath. James 1:20, "The wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God." Psalm 37:8, "Cease from anger and forsake wrath." Ephesians 4:31, "Let all bitterness and wrath and anger be put away from you." Galatians 5:20 lists wrath as a work of the flesh alongside adultery and idolatry. Ephesians 4:26 that says, "Be ye angry and sin not," doesn't mean that you can scream and holler and throw dishes and slam the door and knock a hole in the wall, but don't sin while you're at it. Ephesians 4:26 means when you feel anger starting to rise, watch out. You're about to sin. The heart is much too delicate. The heart of a child is much too delicate to survive the catastrophic explosions of a father's or mother's anger. Sometimes parents lose their child's heart when they break the most serious command given to parents in the Bible. It is found in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. I refer to that command as the most serious command in the Bible to parents because it is the only negative command I know of given directly to parents in relation to their children. The most devastating consequences occur not from breaking positive commands, but from breaking negative commands. The Bible commands us to love our neighbor. It also says, thou shalt not kill. Now, it's bad to break the positive command. It's horrendous to break the negative command. You may provoke your child to wrath by criticizing him unjustly, by speaking to him harshly, by teasing him excessively, or by insulting him publicly. You may provoke your child to wrath by raising the standard required to get your praise and approval so high that he or she cannot reach it. It is entirely possible for a parent to have expectations for his child that are higher than what God expects from the child. Those expectations may easily ruin your relationship. An inexperienced, immature child should not be expected to do a job as well as an experienced, mature, perfectionistic parent. When a child has done his best, he should be praised whether he performed as well as someone else or not. Children also should not be compared to others so as to make them feel inferior. You may provoke your child to wrath by making them do something they're terribly afraid to do. You may provoke your child to wrath by not communicating enough with them, or by spending too much time outside the home, or by being glued to the TV or other personal pleasures too much. The child, to accommodate the hurt of you losing his heart, hardens his heart. And thirdly, after the heart is hardened, someone else can easily come along and steal the heart. When King David didn't listen to the needs of the men of Israel, then they hardened their hearts toward him. Then Absalom came along, saw the weak area, and provided a listening ear, just like wrong friends in our day see the weak areas and provide listening ears. Absalom listened to them, talked to them, and touched them, and stole their hearts away. The things Absalom did to steal the hearts of the men of Israel are the very same things that are used in our day to steal the hearts of young people from their parents. Now, here's the good news. Those same things will also work for parents to steal back the hearts of their sons or daughters from those who stole them away in the first place. Thank God that is true. I've seen it work over and over. Dad and Mom, listen to your child. Then speak kindly with concern to your child while touching them. If you'll listen closely enough to your children, you'll find out where they're hurting and what's bothering them. Proverbs 24:3 says that a house is established by understanding. Look at your child and say tenderly to them, I want to understand. It may be bothering your child that he's starting to have complexion problems. Maybe some friends are making fun of him because of it. Look him in the eyes and listen to him with genuine concern. Don't foolishly say, it's no big deal. Say, thank you for telling me how you feel. I know it hurts when people laugh at you. I remember how it felt. Would you tell me more about it? Your child may feel fat or skinny or ugly or too tall or too short. Listen to them. Some parents say, my children don't want to talk. That is not true. Children want to talk. Let me say that again. Children want to talk, but they want to talk about things that parents often think are unimportant. You and I need to learn that if it's important to our children, then it's important. Period. It doesn't matter what it is. It's important. You see, what I see as my child's needs and what she sees as her needs, I have four daughters, may be two entirely different things. I have to meet my daughter's needs not only as I perceive them, but as she perceives them as well. Do you know what this means? This is my favorite sentence in this entire message. It means that you're taking time to kiss your little girl's dolly because it has a sore toe is more important, Dad, for your happiness 20 years from now than you're taking time today to listen to your boss offer you a raise of $20,000 a year. It means you better care that your little boy got his toy truck stuck in the mud today. I was in my office one day, busily occupied doing church work. Important stuff. But when my telephone rang and my daughter was weeping because one of her kittens had been accidentally killed, I left behind all that important stuff and drove 14 miles home. When I got there, I hugged and loved and spoke comforting words to my girl. Then I went out and buried her kitty. Then I hung around for a couple hours more to make sure she was all right. And then every day for several days, I continued to ask her how she was doing. Now, why did I do that? Because it was an opportunity for me to let my girl know that she had a daddy who was a daddy first and foremost, and then a pastor. I know every father couldn't drop everything like I did and go home, but I could, so I did. You see, I don't have to be a cat lover to be happy in my old age, but I do have to be a child lover. Why do children give their hearts to their friends? Because their friends listen to them. You're not going to raise good children based on how they look on the outside, whether they're conforming or not conforming to your rules. Remember that Michael's parents thought he looked pretty good outwardly just before he ran away from home. You have to reach deeper than the surface. Son, what have you been thinking about? How do you feel about this? Does this bother you? What are you saying to yourself? What did the message at church say to you? Are you reading your Bible? Are you getting answers to your prayers? What are you praying about? What could we do together today? Questions, questions, questions. Read through the Gospels and notice how Jesus was continually asking His disciples questions in order to stay on top of where they were in their spiritual growth and understanding. There is a philosophy about youth work that prevails in many churches in our day. The philosophy is this: hire a youth director to whom the young people give their hearts and let him do lots of things with the youth. Now, that philosophy is not all bad. There are some young people without parents or with parents who refuse to be what God wants them to be, and those young people won't make it unless some godly adult is able to get their hearts and give them some direction. But God's best is not for a youth pastor to spend time with young people. God's best is for parents to spend time with their young people. Number six, only the heart can keep the heart. The hand alone cannot keep the heart. Neither is a spanking likely to turn around a rebellious teen. Can you imagine Michael's parents spanking that 17-and-a-half-year-old young man that doing any good at all? I'm not sure they could have gotten it done if they had wanted to. The first thing to do at any sign of rebellion is not to get exasperated and shove away. The thing to do is to draw closer to the child. A home with a rebellious youth is often filled with a negative, critical atmosphere. That has to be changed. Praise creates an atmosphere of love and joy and acceptance, whether it's in a home or a church. You wouldn't want to attend a church where there's a harsh, critical atmosphere, but it's just as bad in a home as it is a church. If anything, it may be worse. Even a rebel hungers for the praise and acceptance of his father. And did you know if a parent will look diligently, they can find something for which they can praise even the most rebellious child. Praise is like a powerful magnet drawing the heart of a child in the direction of the one who is giving the praise. Criticism is like a magnet working in reverse and repelling, pushing away instead of attracting. And to praise or criticize in the presence of others multiplies the power of the praise or the criticism. If I sincerely praise my daughter in the presence of a dozen people, then I multiply the effectiveness and power of the praise a dozen times. And if I criticize my daughter in the presence of a dozen people, I can easily sever every string that ties our hearts together in 30 seconds' time. Several months ago, I came across a phenomenal statement. It was this: every year children are schooled at home, they become less peer dependent. Then a well-known preacher said to me, "I've noticed that children who are homeschooled are more mature at a younger age." Those statements caught my attention because we've been teaching our children at home for several years now. I've also had the opportunity to observe the results of socialization in the lives of thousands of public school students, Christian school students, and homeschool students. My observation is this: children are better socialized in the family setting of a homeschool environment because they learn to relate to both adults and other youth. I've seen a shy, withdrawn 7-year-old girl pull out of her shell and start walking up to adults and talking to them at church after 3 months of homeschool. I saw my two oldest daughters choose older, godly ladies in their 50s and 60s to be bridesmaids in their weddings along with other girls their own age. Now, think for a moment. We talk about the benefits of socialization, and I'm not totally against a child being with those his own age. But what good thing does a 12-year-old learn from another 12-year-old? I rest my case. I know everyone cannot do homeschool, but if you want to get your child's heart or keep your child's heart, there are very few things other than that that you can do that are as effective as having your children with you all the time. You say, "But do the children get a good education?" Well, the statistics are coming in, and they show that they get a better than average education, but we also need to be very careful that we do not elevate knowledge to a pinnacle that even the Bible doesn't give it. 2 Peter 1:5 gives God's order in this area. And beside this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge. God was not guessing when He gave that order. The top priority is faith, a person's relationship with God. The very next priority is virtue, which is character or moral excellence. After virtue is knowledge. In other words, God sees virtue and character as being more important than knowledge. When God's priorities are not recognized, then we wind up turning out educated fools. People with lots of knowledge, but very little wisdom and character. God also wasn't guessing when He said that wisdom is the principal thing. Only an educated fool believes that men came from monkeys. True wisdom says, great design demands a great designer. More and more in our day we hear, "Trust us. We're scientists. Something comes from nothing." Or, how about this one? "Trust us. We're doctors. We are highly educated. It has a heartbeat, eyes, and brain waves, and it may even suck its thumb, but it's not a baby." An abortionist doctor is an educated fool. I would rather have a child who cannot read and write his own name than have a child who becomes a doctor and doesn't have the wisdom to not murder babies. Better a little knowledge with a lot of wisdom than a little wisdom with a lot of knowledge. Proverbs 18:15 says, "The ear of the wise seeketh knowledge." There may be a time when you have to choose between wisdom and knowledge. If you have to choose, choose attentiveness over algebra, compassion over chemistry, forgiveness over foreign languages, generosity over geography, humility over the humanities, obedience over ophthalmology, self-control over sociology, and truthfulness over trigonometry. As one math professor told his class just before they took their final exam, "There are many good people who cannot pass an exam in trigonometry, but there are no character people who cannot pass an exam in honesty." A parent then needs to take the following steps in order to turn around a rebellious child. Number one, the parents must first acknowledge to God and their child that they have lost their child's heart and sincerely seek forgiveness from both God and the child. Most parents try to first change the child, but God's order is very significant. Do you remember it? Turn the heart of the fathers to the children comes before its reverse. Once the parent is seen as just, then he is ready to reach the one who is disobedient. Turn them to the wisdom, the disobedient, to the wisdom of the just. Luke 1:17 tells us, "Justice usually requires humility on the part of a parent before grace is given to reach the child." This is the reason that counseling with a rebellious teen often accomplishes little or nothing. I remember counseling one evening with a rebellious teen and him coming to the point of apologizing to his parents right there on the spot. Well, but when I brought him in the room and gave him the opportunity to speak, he said nothing. And I was sitting there trying to figure this out. Just a moment ago, he was weeping. He was ready to apologize to his parents for his rebellion and get right with them. Now I bring him in here and he sits here and he looks at them and nothing's coming out of his mouth. Then I remembered, God's order requires the father to apologize first to the child. After the father apologized with tears, the son's tears began to flow, and he did the same. It was a precious moment. Number two, the parents must examine their own lives to make sure they are dedicated fully to God and cleansed of all evil. A parent with sin in his life will find it difficult, if not impossible, to deal with sin in his child's life. Any parent who is not positive that he is a born-again Christian should concentrate first on establishing his own personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Number three, the rebellious child must be completely separated from all negative personal influences. Proverbs 13:20 says, "He that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed." He must be separated from all friends, especially any boyfriend or girlfriend, as well as any family members not totally in agreement with the parent's spiritual objectives. This usually means that homeschool is essential, not even an option. The parent must be so thorough in this area that the child would not even be allowed to attend a Sunday school class with young people his own age without the parent present. It may even be necessary to sleep in the same room with a rebellious child. Sadly, there are times when the child must even be separated from grandparents if they are not supportive of the parents. Number four, the young person must also be completely separated from all negative, impersonal influences. The home should be cleansed of television, radios, bad music tapes, questionable magazines, cell catalogs, and on you must look through the home. Satan will keep ground in a rebel's life if there's anything left whereby he can hold the ground. As one changed rebel said to me, "Starving sin works." Number five, everything bad removed must be replaced with something good. The child cannot become a spiritual vacuum. He will not become a spiritual vacuum. Something will fill in the spot. Number six, the parent should earnestly pray that God would bind all demonic powers that may be influencing his child. Anytime you deal with rebellion, you can be pretty sure that you are dealing with satanic powers. You must not forget that you are not fighting your child. You are fighting the devil for your child. And number seven, the parent must not follow his natural inclination to push away from the child, but must instead draw closer to the child. Both parents must spend hours and hours with the young person. They should talk and walk and work and teach and play and pray and study and share scriptures and on and on. The father especially should commit to give 1 hour a day for a minimum of 6 weeks. Sometimes the best way to do this is for the parent and the child to take an extended trip together. Incidentally, once you get your child's heart, you need to have a heart check every day. Spend a little or a lot of time every day talking and touching and listening to each child to make sure there is no bitterness and no barriers between you and them. Also, try to do something every day to tie new heartstrings between you and your child. Constantly be searching for what you can do to tie fresh heartstrings. Number eight, the child must be continually praised for even the smallest display of any character trait. Even a rebellious child hungers for the praise and acceptance of his father. Praise, remember, is like a magnet pulling a child's heart to you. Remember Absalom crying out for his father's attention after those long years without it. Number nine, parents, especially the father, must continually humble themselves to ask the child's forgiveness for anger, criticism, inconsistencies, and so on, and for failure to communicate, to love, to praise, to care, as God reveals such failures. The parent must especially try to recall where he has broken God's key negative command to parents to provoke not your children to wrath. Number 10, the parent must help the child deal with bitterness and accept and forgive the child as the child begins to open up and share previously hidden sins and failures. Rebels often disclose very shocking things. A parent must decide ahead of time that he will forgive anything. Number 11, find and encourage some other godly man or woman or men or women to spend time with your child. Number 12, the parent must be committed to following God's principles and refuse to yield. Listen carefully. They must be so committed that they will refuse to yield to the pressure that will come, both from outside the home as well as from the child himself, when these principles are first instituted in relation to a rebellious child. I told one set of parents that for the first several days after they instituted these principles, they would think they had climbed on a wild roller coaster and were riding without safety harnesses or lap bars. In some cases, the rebellious child's grandparents may not support the parents in their decision to do whatever they have to do to reach and see the child change. Those parents will then need to find some older couple, along with their pastor, who will encourage them, counsel them, and support them as they apply these principles. Number 13, the parent would be wise to take their child with them to a week-long meeting, such as takes place at a Bible camp or a Bible teaching seminar, so that the child can be exposed to an intensive, extra-heavy dose of the Word of God and the work of the Holy Spirit. Number 14, the parent must be committed to long-range change and not simply a quick fix. The amazing thing about these principles is how quickly they work. To a parent who really applies them, almost any rebel will turn around in about 2 weeks' time. The danger at that point is the parent letting up and the child winding up even worse than they were before. I can almost guarantee that that will happen. Matthew 12, 43 through 45 tells about an unclean spirit leaving a fellow for a short period of time. The spirit returned later and found a clean house. So he left again and found seven other spirits more wicked than himself and just moved right back in. I really believe that the worst rebels you will ever find are rebels who were changed temporarily by parents who themselves refused to permanently change. I would also warn parents not to decide to experiment with two-thirds of these principles and see if things improve. Most of the principles that I just gave you are interconnected and are dependent on one another to work effectively. And if you pick and choose from these principles, you could actually create a runaway. I've had it happen several times. Now, these principles will even work with a runaway child, but the parent must first find a definite way to keep them at home. I would add that other principles must be used to reach runaways who refuse to return home, and we've seen that work as well. Sometimes parents will listen to this message and then ask this question. Brother Davis, what about the parable of the prodigal son? Didn't the father just let him go? My answer to that is this. If you want to apply the principles of Luke 15 instead of the ones that I've given you from the Word of God, as soon as you have a problem, then you can certainly do so. But certain principles are the sharpened axe that deal with major problems as well as they can be. And if you apply the principles of Luke 15, certainly those are applicable at a certain time. But if you apply them right away, do not be surprised when your child winds up in the hog pen, because that is where the prodigal son went. Michael's parents had called me on December the 21st. Here's the rest of their story from Michael's mother. On December the 22nd, Michael left after 11 p.m. We waited till 3 a.m. till he came home. We searched through his room. We found many things we were not ready for. And I cannot tell you publicly all the things that they found. It became obvious to us that he was totally out of control. That was the worst night of our lives. We were sure that, as we were told, Mike was now only to talk to us. We were now his best and his only friends. Christmas was hard. At the family get-together, he sat between us. Never left our sight. He wasn't allowed to talk to anyone at church. Then we got Mike under a week of preaching at a camp, and by the end of the week, God got a hold of him. By the time Mike came home from camp, we were ready to do what God wanted from us. We learned a new love for our family. Here's what else we did. One, got rid of Mike's TV, VCR, tape player, and radio. Let me insert here. I believe one of the most dangerous things a parent can do is allow their child to have a TV or a radio in his room. I think you're almost guaranteeing that you will lose your child. Number two, went to all video stores and refused to allow our name or our children's names on any list. Number three, no car. Number four, no friends. Number five, no phone calls. Number six, we chose some godly men that we did know to start spending time with Mike. Number seven, Dad started spending lots more time with Michael. Number eight, there was no trust, but lots of love. Number nine, we encouraged reading about godly men. We all became best friends. If Mike wanted to see a friend, it was only done if we were around. God truly did the work in Michael's heart and in ours. Only the first month or so was hard. After that, things changed. Mike's parents asked him if there were things he wanted to add to the story. Here are Michael's words. My parents' determination to fight me is what changed my heart. Things would never have changed had my parents not done the things they said and had I not seen they were not giving up. If parents say, my child is 16, 17, 18, or whatever, and they are old enough that there's nothing I can do, they've lost the war. Michael's mother continued, "We never gave up. If we weren't just fighting for our son, we were fighting for the very soul of his future generations. I kept thinking about Michael's children and grandchildren. If our love had driven him away, so be it. But if we'd done nothing, there would have been no hope." Everybody tells you that when they turn 16, there's nothing you can do. Boy, were they wrong. Our second child has been a real joy. We're now doing things to prevent problems. I work at home and part-time from 4:30 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. so I can be home. God has blessed us so much, it's unbelievable. My daughter is my best friend. We as a family have adopted new standards for not dating that all of us are happy with. I am so thankful for God's love toward our family. Michael is now married and has a baby girl. His parents said to me this week, "We now see how much we would have lost if we had not fought for our son." Absalom's story did not end as well as Michael's and his parents'. Absalom's men fought against David's men, and 20,000 of them died. Rebels often sweep others up in their own destruction. Then Absalom fled on a mule, and his long hair caught in the boughs of an oak tree, and he found himself hanging, dangling helplessly between heaven and earth. The father David had pled for his soldiers to deal gently with Absalom. But Joab went straight to helpless Absalom and shot 3 arrows in his chest while he was yet alive. And then 10 other soldiers drew their swords and hacked Absalom's body to pieces. When the messenger came to tell David of the death of his son, David was much moved. He walked weeping up some stairs to a little room. The people heard him crying out as he went, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Parents do not have to live with disobedience and rebellion. God has given us His Word. The principles are here to tell us how to solve our problems if we as parents are willing to pay the price. I close with these personal probing questions. Do you love your children enough to personally change where you need to change? Are you willing to pay whatever price you have to pay to get your children's hearts, to keep their hearts, or to steal back your children's hearts? Are you willing to pay the price, whatever it might be, to raise godly children?